This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. Newslink.
Hello, welcome to Newslink. I'm Matt Herman in Bonn, Germany. Coming up on the program, Europe's economic future looks shaky. As investors begin rounding on Dexia, the Franco-Belgian bank exposed to too much Greek debt, and as Eurozone finance ministers continue to dither, we'll hear how some Italians are trying to put a positive spin on Amanda Knox's acquittal.
So this is the best demonstration about how full of guarantees is the Italian system for the defendant.
And we'll hear how an EU court ruling this Tuesday may change professional sports in Europe. We'll bring you those stories and much more coming up on Newslink here on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. Let's get started. European markets took another hit on Tuesday as fears grew that banks exposed to Greek debt would soon be in need of recapitalization. Particularly hard hit was the Franco-Belgian bank Dexia, which lost a quarter of its value. I asked our correspondent in Brussels, Vanessa Mock, what had touched off the freefall.
It's a series of very worrying events that have happened over the past days. So Sunday, you had the alarm from Athens that it would not be able to meet its budget deficit targets. That, in turn, fueled speculation that a default by Greece was basically nigh on inevitable by now. And that, in turn, of course, spreads panic throughout the banking sector, because if Greece defaults, well, then possibly Italy and Spain will follow, and that could lead to a complete banking sector meltdown. Those are the kind of worst case scenarios. And the reason why Dexia in particular is caught in the middle of all this is that it's one of those banks that is very, very heavily exposed to debt from Greece, from Italy, from all those kind of toxic Eurozone countries. And it relies very much on something that's called short-term borrowing. So in other words, it has to actually get money from the markets every single day in order just to keep going. And because there's been so much concern about its exposure to debt and so much concern in the banking sector in general, it's found it very, very difficult to borrow money. And the ratings agency Moody's caught up on that and said, well, we're going to potentially downgrade you, which is why now it's all panic stations and you're having a whole raft of emergency meetings by the French and the Belgian authorities to try and prop up the bank.
Why are they so keen to prop up this bank? Why don't they just let it go bust if it has to go bust?
They feel that they can't, because in a way you have to kind of think about the whole European banking system as a kind of, well, as a kind of human body. I mean, imagine Dexia is kind of your elbow. You can't just chop off the elbow without the whole body basically being sick. And the fear is that if you let Dexia fail, that will just lead to this almighty kind of domino effect that will then contaminate all sorts of other banks, because what, don't forget, it's not just Dexia that's caught in the eye of the storm. It's also some other really, really big banks, BNP Paribas in France, also the Commerzbank in Germany is looking quite fragile because of that whole debt issue. And so that's why, you know, you're really having these noises out of France and Belgium. Not just we're going to prop up Dexia, but we're also going to keep Greece going for as long as it's possibly as we possibly can, because we cannot have a banking crisis as well as a sovereign debt crisis. That's the kind of noise. But their options are quite limited, and that's the problem.
Well, it's interesting that all this is happening at the same time that the 17 finance ministers of the Eurozone countries are meeting in Luxembourg, where they might be ostensibly discussing what to do about situations like the potential failure of Dexia or whether or not to extend more money to Greece. What sort of noises are coming out of those meetings? Is there any progress being made to fix any of this?
It's lamentably slow, any progress that there is. And any schemes that are being put in place are certainly being kept very tightly under wraps. So I think some of the plans are, but they are still unfortunately very, very sketchy, is that you boost the firepower of the EU's rescue fund, the EFSF, so that you allow it, that's an American idea, to lend money not actually directly to the countries in trouble like Greece, Italy or Spain or Ireland, but actually that you allow them to recapitalize the banks. But the problem then is that the rescue fund, as it is only worth 440 billion euros. And that, when you look at the scale of the kind of crisis that is emerging here, is nowhere near enough. So what they've got to do, first of all, is agree to what many say is a quadrupling or even a fivefold increase of the reserves. And that is going to be very problematic. It's nothing is going to happen at the speed with which markets are reacting. The hope is that somehow European leaders can still get it together by the middle of October, when they have an EU summit, that somehow they'll just, you know, really roll out the big guns. But whether they will actually finally manage to do so, well, I'm not that optimistic.
Vanessa Mark in Brussels. American student Amanda Knox is a free woman. Along with her then-Italian boyfriend, she spent 4 years in jail before an appeals court overturned her guilty verdict for the murder of her British roommate. Most folks in her hometown of Seattle are thrilled to have her back, but the verdict continues to divide Italian public opinion, as Megan Williams reports.
With the judge's words ordering immediate freedom for American student Amanda Knox and her former Italian boyfriend Raffaele Sollecito, the defendants and their families burst into tears of relief. The jury fully acquitted the pair of murder. Both were serving sentences of over 20 years. During the trial, independent experts testified that the small amount of DNA evidence linking the former couple to the crime was not reliable. Outside the courthouse, Knox's younger sister expressed her family's gratitude.
We are thankful for the support we have received from all over the world. People who took the time to research the case and could see that Amanda and Raphael, they were innocent. And last, we are thankful to the court for having the courage to look for the truth and to overturn this conviction.
But not everyone was satisfied with the acquittal. Onlookers crowded in the piazza outside the Perugia court, chanting shame after hearing the verdict. And later, the family of the young murdered student Meredith Kircher held their own press conference. They said they will appeal the verdict. One man, Rudy Guede, is in prison for the crime, but police and prosecutors have always insisted more people were involved. Kircher's brother says the acquittal is a setback for the family seeking the truth.
We do find that we are now left, obviously, looking at this again and thinking how a decision that was so certain 2 years ago has been so emphatically overturned now, which obviously raises further questions, in as much as there is, of course, the third defendant, Rudy Guede, who is convicted, has been appealed and has been upheld. And at the time, I understand the courts agreed that he wasn't acting alone. Of course, if the two who were released yesterday were not the guilty party, then we are now obviously left wondering who is the other person or people. And really, for us, it feels very much almost like back to square one, and the search goes on really to find out what truly happened.
Well, both the Kircher and Knox families have been careful to express their respect for the Italian legal system. The American media, in particular, were highly critical of the first trial, depicting it as justice gone awry. But Italian legal expert Maurizio Bellacosa says the outcome of the appeal is proof of the ample opportunity the Italian system gives defendants.
The Italian system is full of guarantees for the defendants that can ask for a new examination of all the evidences in a second instance trial. That's what happened in particular with a new expert opinion on the technical issues of the case, like the analysis of the DNA traces and so on. So this is the best demonstration about how full of guarantees is the Italian system for the defendant.
An appeal will now be made to the Supreme Court and could take more than a year. Even if the court orders yet another trial, it's unlikely Italy's request to extradite Amanda Knox from the U.S. would be successful. Megan Williams, Deutsche Welle Radio, Rome.
An unusual trial has just resumed in Paris. A retired German surgeon stands accused of killing his 14-year-old stepdaughter some 30 years ago. But he evaded trial until the girl's father arranged to have him kidnapped and delivered bound and gagged to the French police. The surgeon in question is Dieter K., the K being the first letter of his surname, the rest of which is being withheld under privacy laws. He's not in the best of health, as John Lawrenson reports from Paris.
André Bomberski is now an old man. The last half of his life has had one aim. He swore on the grave of his daughter that he'd bring Dieter K. to justice. In October 1982, Bomberski's daughter, Kalinka, was found dead in her bed in a house belonging to her stepfather on the banks of Lake Constance in Germany. K. had given her an injection of a product supposed to help her suntan, but Bomberski never believed it was an accident. The German judiciary decided there was no case against him and refused to put him on trial, but France thought differently. In 1995, K. was tried in absentia and sentenced to 15 years in prison, even though it seemed as if the German would while away his twilight years in Germany. Then, with the year 2012 looming, Bomberski decided to act, because French courts are only allowed to judge crimes committed less than 40 years previously. In October 2009, K. was kidnapped in Bavaria, transported to France and left bound head and foot on the sidewalk in front of the police station in the eastern city of Mulhouse. Now, after overcoming so many obstacles, Bomberski says he's finally fulfilling his promise. It's true that the German judiciary, the German police, the German medico-legal profession, and above all the German political establishment, wanted this trial never to take place, Bomberski told RTL Radio. But now I've almost reached my goal of a fair trial for Mr. K, with an examination of all the evidence. I hope he can now behave like a man who's responsible for his actions, in honour of the memory of Kalinka. But Kay's family is scandalized that this trial is taking place because it's only been made possible by a brutal kidnapping and because, they say, Germany has ruled that there's no case against him, not because he's German, but because there is no case against him. Diana Gunder is Kay's daughter. Of course, he's in a poor state of health, she said. He's nervous and suffers from the injuries he sustained from the beating he was given when he was kidnapped. He's exhausted and in a state of stress, but he knows he's not guilty. We know it too, and he hopes that this will become clear during this trial, that all the stories Mr. Bomberski has told are shown to be false. In September, Bomberski himself will stand trial on charges of kidnapping Dieter K., for which there's a maximum prison sentence of 10 years. John Lawrenson, Deutsche Welle Radio, Paris.
From Bonn, Germany, in the heart of Europe, you're listening to Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm your host, Matt Herman. The verdict in a case before the European Court of Justice brought by a pub owner in Britain may well change the way sport is funded in Europe. It's about watching football, the English Premier League, on television. Karen Murphy was appealing against a large fine she'd been ordered to pay for showing matches in her Portsmouth pub through a Greek descrambler, by which she avoided paying an expensive subscription to the main domestic broadcaster, Sky Sports. You got all that? Ali Barrett has more on the ruling and its potential results.
In pubs up and down the country, fans gather through the English Premier League season to watch some of the best paid players on the planet. Most of these pubs, because they haven't wanted to break the law, pay a subscription to broadcasters such as Sky Sports or ESPN for the privilege of showing these games on big screens. But it's expensive, and that's why Karen Murphy used a Greek decoder through a company called Nova to unencrypt broadcasts and show matches at her pub.
I paid £800 for a year subscription, as opposed to it'd be about £700 a month for Sky in my small pub. In this climate, that's a massive, massive boost to our income. I mean, I just certainly couldn't afford to have Sky. I've never had it because it's far too expensive and I couldn't have it again.
But This, 6 years ago now, sparked a legal battle with Karen Murphy taken to court and being fined thousands of euros. But the European Court of Justice has now ruled that national laws which outlaw the import, sale or use of foreign decoder cards run contrary to freedoms to provide services. This has led to pub landlords around the UK cheering the decision and Karen Murphy's long battle.
It has been quite stressful and it has taken rather a long time, but obviously it was worth it in the end. I'm glad I took it on, even though it's taken up quite a chunk of my life. I'm glad I did it.
The huge wages Premier League clubs pay their players are largely possible because of the huge chunks of TV money coming in every year from the rights holders. So if this ECJ ruling in the long term disrupts that rights industry, Adam Morley of Mishkon Dorea, the law firm, thinks that will have an effect on the game.
There will always be a market for the guy who wants to sit in his armchair and get a quality picture, quality sound in HD in his house. But the mass market just want to see the game. And if it can be effectively streamed and pirated in such a way as is already going on, the value of the rights will decrease and decrease. And I think that will have a knock-on effect on the wages that are paid to footballers.
But, and it's a big but, the ECJ also ruled that while beaming in matches from overseas is not breaching Premier League copyright, any surrounding branded media, such as pre-edited highlights, graphics or anthems, are protected. So it may be by filling match days with branded, copyrighted content like this that the Premier League ensures broadcasters can't get away with streaming its games. Even so, Adam Morley points to the similarities with the music industry.
The Premier League will not be able to cut their rights up on a country-by-country basis, which has a huge effect on value. When you think about the music parallel, and people have been driven from making money out of music to making money out of concerts, and you wonder whether it might go full circle and people will now view the match as where they make most of their income.
The Premier League will certainly be considering its options, including the possibility of a pan-European tender, as it prepares to sell its next TV rights deal from 2013 onwards. And the ECJ's decision does still need to go to the High Court in London for a final ruling. Ollie Barrett, Deutsche Welle Radio, London.
Perspectives on the news from a uniquely European point of view. You're tuned into Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio from Bonn, Germany. I'm your host, Matt Herman. We all find ourselves channel surfing now and again, looking for some kind of light entertainment. Among the more enticing options at times is an old standby, the cooking show. And I'm sure you've noticed that cooking shows have grown ever more high concept in recent years. It's not just step-by-step cooking instruction. It's got to be a contest of some kind. Even those pitting ordinary people against each other at who can throw the best dinner party, a la Come Dine With Me, which you might have seen on BBC America. Well, some people liked that show so well that they decided to do without the camera crew, spawning a whole new website that allows fans to plan their own events for strangers. Nick Martin reports from Milton Keynes in the UK.
The theme tune is instantly recognisable in 26 countries. Come Dine With Me, or Das Perfekte Dinner as it's known in Germany, is regular viewing for millions of food lovers.
Some of the contestants are really two-faced. I love that. I just think it's so funny.
And I see everybody trying new recipes for the guests, and something doesn't go right. And it doesn't turn out the way you want it.
If you haven't seen the show, Come Dine With Me invites groups of strangers to host dinner parties at each other's homes, cooking food they've prepared themselves. And of course, this being TV, the guests are carefully selected to wind each other up.
If I get to people's houses and all I'm served is supermarket food from a packet, I'll be very, very unhappy.
Each guest gets to rate the host's cuisine and hospitality out of 10. Once all the contestants have played dinner party host, the one with the highest score wins a cash prize. Such is the show's success that a young British wannabe entrepreneur has created a website based on the idea, where people can meet online and arrange to host or attend their own dinner parties. 23-year-old Christopher Tal doesn't have millions in venture capital backing. He saved his own cash to build and market the site. The idea for dinner party social media has already taken off in America, but Foodhost claims to be the first of its kind in the UK. Tal says he's already had a lot of interest from residents in his hometown, Milton Keynes.
Users can sign up for free, and then they can scroll through a list of events, existing events, where they can book a place, or they can create a completely new event and invite the people around them to come.
One issue that comes to mind is the question of security. Won't it be dangerous to invite complete strangers to your house? Tal says he's confident his team have taken precautions to ensure users can stay safe.
The reason we charge is because it adds to the safety layer of the site. We found that if we didn't charge, then anyone could just come along and create some kind of potential problem. So this is a way where we vet members.
Chorizo and goat's cheese salad.
I don't actually know what chorizo is, but the goat's cheese salad, that should be nice.
Starter is a strawberry salad. I'm not really sure what that is.
Although the TV cameras won't be rolling, unless you bring one yourself, there's no doubt that Foodhost could make for some really fun and enjoyable dinner parties. At less than the equivalent of €5 a go, hosts will have the option to invite their own guests or to open their banquet to any registered member on a first-come, first-served basis. There's one condition. You're not allowed to charge guests for their dinner.
So, on to the main course. Moroccan lamb with spiced couscous and raita. Served with mini roast potatoes in thyme and rosemary. First, Vicky covers the lamb in a marinade of coriander, thyme, bay leaf, red chillies, ginger and paprika.
When the party's over, guests can rate their experience online, just like in the TV show.
Overall, I had a really crap night. So for that, I'm really sorry to say I'm going to give Vicky a 5.
But what do die-hard fans of Come Dine With Me think of a website offering a similar experience?
Oh, that sounds interesting.
Yeah?
Yeah, it sounds good.
Do you think you could do it?
I don't know. I might, after a few glasses of wine, I might be able to. Maybe.
My house is open to everybody. And if anyone will come and try my curry, it's most welcomed.
What about going to somebody else's house? Would you do that?
I just don't know. Just so that you don't know the people. You don't know what they're going to be like. Or
it's just like going to a party, isn't it, really? Having some food and...
So I'm so fussy about my food and how it's prepared. If they cook any meat or anything or beef, I wouldn't go.
With Come Dine With Me attracting around 2 million British TV viewers, Foodhost owner Tal says his social media site can be a big success.
If we can capture the imagination and the enthusiasm of foodies or anyone who just loves cooking or eating food, then hopefully we can be in every major city and town in the UK in 5 years' time. What we've focused on is we've built a system where we can scale it. If there is that demand, that extra demand for it, then we can respond quickly and deliver.
Tal says he's not actively looking for other investors as yet, but isn't there a danger that really big internet players could come in and overtake him?
This market is quite big for several players to put in. Competition will only drive us to produce a better service. So, and not only that, it validates that you do have a real business there and what you're doing is working.
For fans wishing to have their own Come Dine With Me experience, the website offers a chance to socialise with some new and interesting people. But Foodhost fans should know that dinner guests are just like ingredients. Some just don't go that well together. Nick Martin, Deutsche Welle, Milton Keynes.
This is Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio. My name is Matt Herman. You're listening to Deutsche Welle Radio's Newslink. I'm Matt Herman. Coming up on the next 30 minutes of Newslink, we'll hear why one man in Britain is determined to break the world record for dancing.
Throughout my life, I've always loved dancing, and I suddenly thought that actually the feeling that I get when I dance, and I dance really badly, like a dad at a wedding, is that I'm free. So we thought dance is the perfect symbol. The freedoms that people have here, they might not recognise or use, but that people don't have over in Burma.
We'll have that story in a few minutes, but first to Russia, where a former vice president of the now-defunct oil company Yukos, Vasily Alexanyan, has died of complications caused by AIDS. Human rights activists say he contracted it in prison, and it was worsened by poor treatment that he got during his two-year term, one he served in connection to the case against former Russian oil tycoon and Kremlin critic Mikhail Khodorkovsky. Herr Korkamp reports.
The untimely death of Vasily Alexanyan prompted the independent newspaper Novaya Gazeta to publish a list on its website containing the names of all those who were somehow involved in the trial that ultimately proved fatal for him. Among the 31 officials are judges and prosecutors, as well as investigators like Salavat Karimov. He also headed the first investigation against former oil tycoon Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the head of the oil company Yukos, where Alexanyan briefly held the post of vice president. During one of the court hearings, Alexanyan, already very ill, told journalists from his cage-like cell that Karimov personally had urged him to incriminate Khodorkovsky and his business partner Platon Lebedev. He told me, Alexanyan said, "The leadership of the prosecutor's office understands that you need treatment, maybe even outside Russia. You're in a serious condition." And he told me, "We need your statements as a witness because we cannot prove the allegations we have made against Khodorkovsky and Lebedev. And if you give us the statements the investigation needs, then we will release you." And he proposed me the concrete mechanism of this deal. But Alexanyan never admitted guilt, nor did he provide anything the investigators had pressed for. "It's a conspiracy between the court, the prosecutor's office and the prison," he said. "They do everything to convict people and then say that I'm a criminal. I'm innocent. I did not commit a crime." Vasily Alexanyan was arrested in 2006 for alleged embezzlement and money laundering. Soon after his arrest, it turned out he was seriously ill and diagnosed with AIDS. In prison, his condition quickly deteriorated. Alexanyan developed tuberculosis and cancer. Still, the authorities refused to release him from prison and allow him to get critical medical help. "Who am I? Jack the Ripper? Did I blow up a train? Did I kill 200 people? How can they justify what's happening?" In early 2009, he was released on more than 1 million euros bail. The money was raised with great difficulty. Last year, the charges against him were dropped due to the expiration of the statute of limitations. Geert Koerkamp, Deutsche Welle Radio, Moscow.
Around the world, around the clock. News and perspectives from the heart of Europe on DWTV, Deutsche Welle Radio, and online too at dwworld.de. All right, technophiles around the world turned their attention not to Europe, but to Cupertino, California this Tuesday for the big unveiling of Apple's new iPhone model. They thought they'd get an iPhone 5. It turned out to be just an iPhone 4S, which in the end meant the thing looks just the same, but has more computing power, better software, some new features like better voice recognition and camera resolution, etc. But a growing number of people are less interested in Apple's new features than trying to get the company to clean up its act when it comes to the rights of workers. I spoke with Cornelia Heidenreich, who heads a corporate accountability project called Make IT Fair here in Germany, and asked her what brought Apple's manufacturing chain in particular to her attention.
Actually, this discrepancy between their profits and the situation on the ground is why we picked Apple and said we want to see some changes. We want to see Apple to be a front runner not only in innovative products, but also in working conditions. And so far we don't see that, and that's why we think we have to raise this issue again with Apple, and we want to use this launch of a new product today to also call on Apple to improve the working conditions of their suppliers.
There has been a lot of talk in recent months about just how worthy the company Apple is. It's more worthy than General Motors. It's more worthy than Exxon. It's the most worthy product-making company in the world. How much would it really cost them to treat their workers a bit better?
There was a company, iSupply, last year, which said only 1% of the selling price of an iPhone is for the wage for workers in the supply chain. So, I mean, if they would raise their wage a bit, then the profit would only be a bit smaller. But to really provide detailed numbers, that's not possible for us as NGOs because we don't have all the detailed information about their internal data and budgets.
Well, a lot of IT and consumer electronics companies, be it Apple or Nokia or Samsung or whoever, have manufacturing plants in China. In some cases, devices made by these competing products are being made almost in the same facility. What is it that makes Apple stand out to your group as far as a company that is ignoring calls for better working conditions more than some others?
We have the impression that Apple is especially reluctant when it comes to reacting to specific problems and cases, to first to be transparent about what happens and to directly get into dialogue with the affected people, but also with NGOs working on these issues. And on the other hand, we think that Apple has the most money available to really implement changes and to start something different. And for instance, it's true that in most of the factories, the workers produce products for different brand companies. But for instance, a recent report made by a partner organization of us based in Hong Kong, that's a report about a factory which is mainly producing for Apple. So there, Apple would really have a big influence to change the situation on the ground.
Cornelia Heidenreich of German Watch there. German President Christian Wolff gave out a bunch of medals this Tuesday, one of the duties of his largely ceremonial office. Among the 36 Germans awarded the Officer's Cross of the Order of Merit of Germany was Marcel Gleffe, a 32-year-old roofer by profession. Gleffe has been hailed as a hero in Germany after helping rescue a number of teenagers who were fleeing from the gunman who perpetrated the Utøya Island massacre in Norway in July. Uwe Hessler has more.
President Christian Wolff said the 36 citizens who were awarded the Officer's Cross had upheld those values which Germany cherishes most. He paid special tribute to Marcel Gleffe, whose bravery added a consoling note to the unbelievable tragedy that took place on the Norwegian island of Utøya. In July this year, Gleffe and his parents, Walter and Heidrun, happened to be vacationing in Utvika, a camping ground situated just 600 meters away from Utøya Island in Norway. On the morning of July the 22nd, as Gleffe recalls, the family were discussing the bomb attack in Oslo, which had just happened. Suddenly, they heard rifle shots echoing across the Utøya Island. They saw the heads of people bobbing in the water, he says, and heard people yelling for help. Marcel Gleffe jumped into the small boat the family had hired and began a rescue operation which he says he'll never forget, but which he wouldn't hesitate to do all over again.
Nach wie vor würde ich sagen, also immer noch selbstverständlich.
I still think it's normal to act like this after seeing all those people in need of help, he says. There's no doubt that I would do it all over again. Marcel Gleffe didn't count how many teenagers he actually saved during the shooting massacre carried out by Norwegian extremist Anders Breivik. Some say he managed to drag as many as 24 from the icy waters. He then ferried them to the safety on the opposite shore where his parents were waiting. He saved them virtually at the last minute, as this survivor of the massacre says.
The water was freezing cold, but I thought it was better to swim than be on the island. And I got this floating vest from a boat. And without this, I would have drowned because the water was maybe about 16 degrees cold.
Marcel Gleffe is 22 years old and a roofer by profession. He moved to Norway because of a job just over 2 years ago. He's rather shy and feels a bit uncomfortable about all the media attention he's received since the summer. He also believes that he isn't the only one who deserves to receive such honors. It's a big honor, and naturally I'm proud of it, he says. But I've said time and again that I accept it on behalf of all the rescuers and my own family, because without them we wouldn't have been able to save so many lives. Uwe Hessler, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
Tempers are running short in Germany's center-right coalition. Or at least they were a few days ago, when aides to Chancellor Merkel were struggling to persuade dissident government legislators to fall into line and vote for the Eurozone rescue package. In the end, the Chancellor got her majority, but at a price. One of her aides was found to have used some rather coarse language. Hardy Grautner reports.
The head of Germany's Interior Affairs Committee in Parliament, Wolfgang Bosbach, has for decades been a highly respected lawmaker from Chancellor Angela Merkel's Christian Democrat Party. But in the eyes of Merkel's chief of staff, Ronald Pofalla, Bosbach made an unforgivable mistake by straying from party lines and deciding to vote against the extension of the Euro bailout fund. Before the crucial vote last week, Pofalla was reported to have told Bosbach that he couldn't stand the sight of his stupid face anymore. Confronted with such a below-the-belt attack, Bosbach said he was utterly dismayed and disappointed. Of course, I knew right from the start that I'd run into trouble if I voted against the majority of my party comrades, he said. But some folks in my party didn't shy away from launching some very personal insults, and that's something I can't really shrug off. Bosbach has since announced that he will rethink his political future as a national lawmaker. His party comrade Peter Hinze has been trying hard to calm emotions and trivialize Pofalla's gaffe. Isn't it also a question of political culture to separate private talks from public conversations, he asked. Both protagonists have said they've decided to let bygones be bygones, so why is the media making such a fuss about it? Opposition leaders such as Green Party floor leader Jürgen Trittin said the Chancellor should have intervened in the face of Pofalla's unacceptable behaviour, recalling that it was by no means the first time that lawmakers from the ruling Christian and Free Democrats had chosen to trade verbal insults. In this case, she should have drawn the right lessons from the first 2 years of this coalition government, he said. That was the time when the centre-right coalition partners prefer to call each other a bunch of good-for-nothings and wild hogs. Speaking of wild hogs, names from the animal kingdom have a long history of being misused in political debates in Germany. Among the things that generations of German legislators and ministers have openly called each other have been barking hamster, dishonest viper, Christmas goose, Schweizer panther, and even hospitalized hippo. Given the current tension in the government coalition, this is a list that stands a good chance of being extended before long. Hardy Graupner, Deutsche Welle Radio, Berlin.
Information and perspectives from a European point of view. Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. I'm your host, Matt Herman. Leaders of the Czech Republic's large Roma minority say they intend to form a political party by the end of the year to defend the community's interests in the wake of worsening social and economic discrimination. The leaders said the decision to seek political representation had been made more urgent by recent anti-Roma riots in the north of the country. Rob Cameron has more from Prague.
Serious disorder in the Czech Republic's Šluknov region this summer as crowds of local people bolstered by far-right activists attempt to march on squalid housing inhabited mainly by Roma people. The marchers, prevented from reaching their destination by riot police, were the result of several violent assaults apparently committed by Romanis. But Roma leaders complain that local people have been whipped up into a racist frenzy by a handful of isolated incidents, further worsening relations between Roma and their neighbours. Roma leaders now plan to establish a new political party to give Roma people a voice and encourage dialogue with their Czech neighbours. The plan is to field candidates in communal elections in areas where Roma live in virtual ghettos, but they also have ambitions to send MPs to the National Parliament in Prague. Veteran Roma leader Czeniak Ružička is one of the organisers.
We've been considering the idea for some time, given the state of relations between us and the majority of society. But what's been happening in Shluknov has made it more urgent. We're fully aware how bad things could get. I'm an original Czech Roma. My family are from here, and I know what happened in the 30s and during the war. I know how things could turn out.
There are an estimated 200,000 to 300,000 Roma living in the Czech Republic, most of them descended from immigrants from eastern Slovakia. There are perhaps a few thousand Romanis who live integrated and relatively untroubled lives, but the majority live in social exclusion, with little education or employment prospects and, frankly, loathed by the rest of society. They have, at present, no political representation. A Romani party last had seats in parliament in the early 1990s. Today, there are no mainstream political parties appealing specifically to Roma. So, with that in mind, can this new party be a success? Gwendolyn Albert is an independent human rights consultant who's worked with Czech Roma for many years.
I think what the organizers of this effort are really aiming at is some sort of political organization of the Roma community. They're acknowledging the fact that the Roma need to get organized, they need to get a seat at the table, so to speak, and that's what they're trying for. And we'll just have to see how successful they are, because things are getting pretty desperate with respect to the public discourse about them.
The party, which has the working name ADAI, the Romani word for here, is at the committee stage and is currently garnering signatures to allow for registration as a political party. Some analysts are sceptical it could succeed at anything higher than a very local level, given the lack of political consciousness amongst Czech Roma. But there are examples from elsewhere in Europe, Croatia and Romania to name but two, where Roma MPs sit in Parliament and help represent their community at a national level. Rob Cameron, Deutsche Welle Radio, Prague.
1 year ago, Hungary was struck by its worst environmental disaster in living memory. At least 10 people died and 150 others were injured when towns and villages were flooded with toxic sludge from an alumina plant. An area of some 40 square kilometers was devastated, including the village of Kolontar. Stefan Boss traveled there and sent us this report on how things have been going.
People at a church in Kolontar are remembering those who lost their lives 1 year ago when over 180 million gallons of red sludge flooded the village. A reservoir wall collapsed, unleashing a torrent of toxic waste from a nearby aluminium plant. Near this Kolontar church, local residents are helping to establish an ecumenical memorial park. Over 300 families lost their homes in what became Hungary's worst ever disaster. At least 120 people were injured and 10 killed, including an elderly couple and their daughter, a man who tried to rescue his friends, and a baby. 40 months old Anjelka, meaning angel, drowned in the toxic wave of red sludge. Her mother, Erzsébet Juhász Zsoltáné, still has her picture and the child's stroller next to her when watching television. Juhász Zsoltáné now lives in one of the over 100 new homes built by the government. She says she will never forget that fateful afternoon, October 4th, 2010.
All of a sudden, there was a wave of mud entering the house through the windows, and then I started to look for a small baby in the mud with my bare hands, and I couldn't find the baby anymore, and the wave was coming and coming, and my husband told that we should urgently run upstairs. Later, in about 3 hours, we were taken out from the home, and the baby was found next day at 11 o'clock dead in the mud.
Folyt az az iszap.
Church bells rang Tuesday for Angelka and 9 others who passed away. The red-colored streets and a few cars with red dust still provide a constant reminder of last year's accident and the cleanup efforts that followed. 57-year-old farmer Janos Fuchs, who now suffers from cancer, lost his elderly mother in the tragedy. He and his wife were among those who received new homes from the government. But the tears and nightmares remain, he says. He says, I drove on my tractor and I waved to my mother. It was the last time I saw her. Soon after, while working the land, I saw what appeared to be a tsunami of red mud. That was toxic sludge, a byproduct of aluminium production. The farmer adds, I saw another flood wave about 2 meters high. Because I was on a tractor, I managed to find higher ground and was able to survive this way. But I saw a man who tried to save his friend's wife and her daughter. Even he drowned in his Jeep vehicle. I searched frantically for my mother, but she too died in the mud. The town's struggling farmers have only just started working their lands again. After removing most of the sludge, local authorities provided them with new fields to plant their crops. Yet environmentalists remain concerned about the long-term impact of the disaster. Hard-working residents who lost their loved ones say it's little satisfaction that the owner of the Aika alumina plant was fined about $650 million because of the disaster. They say nothing in the world can ever compensate for the lives that were lost in what was Hungary's worst ever chemical accident. Stefan Bos, Deutsche Welle Radio, Kolontár, Hungary.
News and information from the heart of Europe, Newslink on Deutsche Welle Radio, Germany's international broadcaster. Dancing nonstop for one evening is probably enough to tire out most of us. So try dancing for 5 days straight. That's what Ben Hammond, a young teacher from London, is going to attempt to do later this month, as he tries to break the record for the world's longest dance. He's already become the first person to dance the London Marathon, and this record attempt is the next step in raising money and awareness for a cause close to his heart. After spending a year teaching in Burma, Ben returned to the UK and set up a charity called Learn Burma, which is all about strengthening ties between the two countries. Catherine Bolsover went to meet up with Ben Hammond in training.
It's a bright, sunny day in central London, and while people sit out in the park eating lunch, one lone man is standing in the middle of the park and dancing. His name's Ben Hammond, and he's in training for a world record attempt to dance for 131 hours. He's currently wearing a neon T-shirt with the logo Free to Dance written on it and a bright yellow sweatband. So, Ben, I don't want to stop you while you're busy in training, but can you perhaps tell me about yourself and what's this dancing business all about?
I direct a charity called Learn Burma, which tries to educate young people here in the UK about what's happening in Burma. And I guess in my title, I also have World Record Attempter. Throughout my life, I've always loved dancing, and I suddenly thought that actually the feeling that I get when I dance, and I dance really badly, like a dad at a wedding, but the feeling I get when I do it is that I'm free, and it doesn't matter who's watching, it doesn't matter what's going on, when I'm really feeling great, when I'm dancing, it's I'm free to dance. So we thought dance is the perfect symbol of the freedoms that people have here. They might not recognise or use, but which people have here, and that people don't have over in Burma. So we thought, let's use dance. It's the perfect vehicle to raise awareness of Burma.
You're not just dancing in your living room. You're dancing quite publicly at the moment. You're dancing in a pub.
Sure.
It's really infectious, actually.
Yeah, you want to jog about, don't you? You want to kind of move.
I feel awful standing here with the microphone. I should be moving, right, but your moves are far better than mine.
Hey.
What are you building up for? What is all this public dancing and encouraging people to dance? Mm-hmm. What's it all building up towards?
So far, if you look at the little thermometer on my website, it shows that I've danced this year with 18,000 people. And those people have been in schools, they've been on top of mountains, they've been, as I've danced the London Marathon, as I've danced through festivals, Glastonbury, WOMAD, etc. We're gearing up for the world's longest ever dance. So I'll be attempting the world's longest ever dance. So I'll be dancing badly, but for a long, 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 long time. And I've got to dance for 131 hours, pretty much non-stop. You get 5 minutes off an hour for health and safety reasons, thanks Guinness World Records. And at the same time, so that whole dance will be done as a silent disco. So it's also going to be the world's greatest silent disco, where 10,000 people will come for a four-hour slot each to dance alongside me and what have you, and just to celebrate their freedom.
And how many people are you expecting to come down for this?
Oh, well, our target is 10,000 people, which is kind of a lot of people. So that's why we partnered with real specialist organisations in each kind of music and dance form, because us ourselves, well, you can clearly see... Sorry, listeners, you can't hear, but you can clearly see that I can't dance, and I would not attract many people to dance with me. But those organisations we've partnered with, through their expertise in the area, that's how we're hoping to get the people.
You mentioned that your style of dancing. Mm-hmm. What kind of comments have you attracted, or what have people shouted out to you in the street whilst you've been in training for this big event?
Well, often, because I've got my headphones on, I can't actually hear the comments, which is usually a good thing, I think. When I first went around the country with my sign, which just said, "Are you free to dance with me?" It was a sort of open invitation for people to join in. The funniest reactions were in two places where people called the police, which was quite funny. These days, I have a huge sign that I wear on my back. It's like a big harness thing that says, "Are you free to dance?" And people get it quite quickly, and they come up and dance. So it's got to the stage where people, if I go to a festival, people will recognise me. You're the guy that danced the London Marathon, you're the guy that danced with Glastonbury, etc. And they just come and join in, I think, now. It's kind of getting there, yeah.
It probably helps having a giant sign. It's like, I'm not a total weirdo.
The giant sign helps. Well, although, yeah. People can still surmise that I am a total weirdo, but hey, that's up to them.
Right, you mentioned there Guinness, the lovely people at the World Record.
Yes.
Place. They let you have 5 minutes off every hour.
Yes.
This is still not enough to sleep or eat properly. How are you going to survive?
Actually, it's just about enough, because what you can do is you can add those 5 minutes together up to a maximum of 20 minutes off every 4 hours. So that's how we've done it. That's why they're 4 hour blocks, because that's based around my kind of schedule. And so I will have, in that time, I'll have a little toilet time and a little sleep time. Probably about 10 minutes every 4 hours, which gives you about an hour's sleep a night for 5.5 days, and then every other moment of your life is dancing, which is a bit odd. Interesting. I mean, I have to eat while I'm dancing, basically. So I mean, that saves a little time. Doesn't help the tummy, but...
Are you going to be like an astronaut and have all your food in liquid form and so that you can easily eat it on the go? Or surely can't eat a burger whilst you're dancing.
Well, hold on. Look, I mean, I'm talking to you now, and I could probably be working my way through a veggie, but I'm vegetarian, working my way through a veggie burger at the same time. I think I could. I did at Glastonbury. I was chomping away as I was dancing. But, you know, there's levels of dancing. I mean, I'm managing to talk to you okay. I'm not too out of breath. And so you just have to tone it down a bit when you're having your snacks.
Digesting, it's very important.
It's true.
I'm worried you might get cramp. And what for you would be the best thing after you've done this 5-day marathon of dancing? Mm-hmm. What do you hope that both people get out of it, and what do you hope that your charity will achieve out of this?
Yeah, I mean, really, it's about getting the people to come down and to massively enjoy their experience and raise a little bit of money for Learn Burma to do its work. So it's less about me, in a sense. I'm kind of the slightly weird human interest story. So it doesn't really matter about me. It more matters about the experience that people have, and we just want to give everyone the best time that they've had when they come down, other than, you know, us, you know, trying to raise as much money as we can.
You can watch Ben's world record attempt live on his website. That's free2dance.com, by the way. And that's all for this edition of Newslink. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you'll tune in again sometime soon. I'm Matt Herman. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.